Welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are undertaking a very specific mission. You can basically think of this as stepping into a seminar with us.
Right.
But, you know, instead of some dusty lecture hall, we are going to explore the modern architecture of privacy.
Yeah, we're unpacking a highly specific, honestly fascinating philosophical case study from our sources today.
Mm-hmm.
We really want to examine exactly how we experience privacy in physical spaces, how we define it conceptually, and ultimately, and this is the big one, how those exact same definitions quietly govern the algorithms of artificial intelligence and social media that you use every single day.
Every single day. It's a necessary progression from what we've looked at before.
Absolutely. Because in our previous analyses, we established a baseline for how privacy functions on an intuitive gut level.
Right.
We looked at those massive historical and commercial touchstones, you know, the invention of the television, shifting the boundary of the living room.
It's a cultural phenomenon of Elvis.
Exactly, Elvis. And of course, that infamous target predictive analytics case.
Oh, man, the target case. For anyone who doesn't remember, that was when a corporate algorithm figured out a teenage girl was pregnant, based entirely on her subtle shifts in buying habits.
Unscented lotion.
Unscented lotion, vitamin supplements. And it started mailing her baby coupons before she'd even told her father.
Yeah.
That story is the ultimate example of what a privacy violation feels like in our bones. It's that visceral shiver of, wait, how do you know that about me?
Exactly. Those examples taught us the feeling of the violation. But today, we are transitioning from that visceral feeling to the theoretical architecture that either justifies or condemns that feeling.
Moving from the intuitive to the structural.
Right. We need to understand the rules of the game.
Okay. Let's unpack this structural reality by starting with a physical case study from our source material. And honestly, this is where it gets really interesting.
It does.
Because it sounds like the plot of a thriller. It centers around a photography exhibition titled The Neighbors. But to truly grasp the ethical weight of this, you need to picture the exact geography of the dilemma.
The physical layout is paramount here.
Right. So we are in Tribeca. For those who haven't been, it's a neighborhood in Lower Manhattan known for cobblestone streets and wildly, almost absurdly expensive real estate.
Extremely expensive.
Yeah. And on one side of this particular street, you have the Zinc Building. And the defining architectural feature of the Zinc Building is that its apartments are constructed almost entirely of pure glass windows.
Floor to ceiling.
Floor to ceiling. It is a literal monument to transparency.
And positioned directly across the narrow street from this modern glass monument is a traditional opaque brick building.
Okay.
This is where the primary actor in our case study enters the picture. A photographer named Ani Spencer, who is sometimes referred to in the literature as Ari Spencer, lived in that traditional brick building.
Right across the street.
Right across the narrow street. And from the vantage point of his darkened apartment, he began taking photographs of the inhabitants living in the pure glass apartments of the Zinc Building.
And the details of these photographs are what make the whole scenario so arresting and honestly a little creepy.
Oh, highly creepy.
He isn't photographing empty, beautifully decorated living rooms. He is zooming in on the subjects going about their intimate daily lives.
Yeah.
They're sleeping on their sofas. They are resting. They're in their pajamas. Crucially, though, Spencer never shows their faces.
That's a key detail.
Yeah, the framing deliberately obscures their identities in the traditional sense. You only ever see the backs of their heads or a shoulder or their profiles.
Yeah.
But the profound intimacy of the domestic space is entirely, undeniably captured.
And the outcome of this action elevates the scenario from simple, quiet observation to commercial commodification.
Right.
Spencer did not merely keep these photographs hidden away in a private portfolio. He enlarged these images. He blew them up to giant sizes and sold them in a high-end art space.
Wow.
Specifically, the Julie Saul Gallery, which is also located right there in Tribeca. He literally monetized the captured domesticity of his neighbors.
So if I'm putting myself in the shoes of the people living in the Zinc Building, I am immediately confronted with a profound philosophical dilemma regarding how I experience the value of privacy.
Yes.
You walk into a gallery, you look at these massive wall-sized photographs of yourself sleeping in your own home, and the immediate visceral reaction is that a boundary has been violently crossed. Call the police, sue the gallery, right?
What's fascinating here is the underlying philosophical tension. If we evaluate this purely on a deontological level, which is the ethical framework focusing on duty, rules, and consent, we have to ask a simple question. Did the subjects in the Zinc Building consent to being photographed?
Definitely not.
Absolutely not. They did not explicitly reveal these aspects of their domestic lives to the public. They certainly did not sign a release form granting permission for their personal information and vulnerable moments to be captured.
Let alone commodified and hung on the stark white walls of a gallery for strangers to buy.
Exactly. By standard ethical frameworks regarding consent, a clear, undeniable violation has occurred.
Wait, I have to push back on that because the architecture of the Zinc Building forces a massive counterargument, right? We're talking about implicit consent.
Okay, let's hear it.
The subjects in those photographs didn't just end up in a glass box by accident. They actively chose to buy or rent and live in an apartment made entirely of glass.
That's true.
They spent a massive premium in one of the most expensive real estate markets in the entire world for that specific transparent design.
You're hitting on the exact irony of the architectural design, which is central to this whole ethical dilemma. Why do people buy glass apartments?
For the view. They want to look out at the Manhattan skyline.
Precisely. The inhabitants purchase those specific apartments for the magnificent views out onto the city. But by prioritizing the view out, they inherently and unavoidably created magnificent views in.
Wow.
And this becomes especially true at night. When the sun goes down and the interior lights are turned on, a glass apartment becomes a brilliantly illuminated stage.
It's basically a theater.
It reverses the mirror entirely. Everyone on the street, and certainly everyone in the brick building across the way, can see every single thing happening inside.
So what does this all mean for our definition of privacy? Are we saying that if you actively choose to reside in a transparent box, you are implicitly surrendering your expectation of privacy? Like, you can't buy a fishbowl and then get mad when people look at the fish.
That is the crux of how we must define privacy theoretically. Privacy, in this framework, cannot be understood as a static state of being.
What do you mean by static?
It's not a magical aura that just exists around you regardless of context. It must be understood as a continuous series of decisions. It is a continuously negotiated boundary.
Oh, I see.
If privacy is fundamentally about the decisions you make regarding access to yourself, then choosing to live in an apartment of pure glass is a monumental, highly consequential decision regarding your privacy.
Because it's a physical choice you made.
Yes. No rational actor can walk into a completely transparent home and fail to realize that the visual access is bidirectional. By choosing to make that specific space your private refuge, you are actively introducing a staggering vulnerability into your own sanctuary.
Okay, but we have to add a few more layers to this because the real world is messy. There are variables here from our sources that stretch this dilemma even further.
Let's look at them.
The first is the geographical variable. This exhibition, these buildings, this photographer, they are all in New York City. And the source material highlights a very specific reality of New York. Cameras are ubiquitous.
Ubiquitous.
You are in an environment where tourists, locals, security systems, dash cams people are constantly, incessantly taking pictures of random things at all times.
Which forces us to ask how environmental norms alter ethical baselines. Does the reality of a surveillance-heavy environment fundamentally change the calculus of a privacy violation?
Right, because everyone expects it.
Think about it. If you exist in a reality where you know definitively that everyone is taking pictures of everything, does that knowledge dilute your right to be upset when you inevitably become the subject of one of those pictures?
Yeah.
If the expectation of observation is absolute, does the expectation of privacy simply cease to exist?
That's a terrifying thought, because if everyone's doing it, then no one is guilty.
Right.
But beyond the geographical location, we have the, well, the why of it all. The source talks about the teleological variable.
Yes. Teleology is the philosophical study of ends, purposes, or goals. It asks, what was the ultimate aim of the action?
Right. So does the end use of the captured information change the ethical rules? If this guy Spenson was taking these photos purely for voyeurism or to blackmail these wealthy neighbors, we'd easily call him a criminal.
Without a doubt.
But the photographs were framed, exhibited, and sold as art. Does slapping the label of artistic expression on the output somehow alter the moral weight of him snooping into their living rooms in the first place?
It is a very common defense in philosophical aesthetics. The argument suggests that the artistic intent, the pursuit of a higher cultural truth, somehow sanitizes the non-consensual extraction of the image.
Sanitizes it. Interesting.
But as you can probably feel, it leaves us in a deeply ambiguous space. We have strict, rule-based violations of consent crashing headfirst into the implicit consent of architectural choices.
Right.
And all of that is being modified by environmental realities and the end goals of the photographer. It is a perfectly constructed ethical gridlock.
And it would be easy to just leave it there as a fun debate for an art history class.
Yeah.
But we need to take this highly specific physical ethical gridlock and translated to the digital reality you, the listener, interact with every single day.
This is the crucial leap.
Because the physical architecture of the Zinc Building in Tribeca, that is the exact foundational blueprint for the architecture of artificial intelligence and modern social media platforms.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the parallel is essentially flawless. Creating an account on a social media platform, whether we are talking about Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, dating applications, or even newer systems utilizing advanced emotion AI.
Which are everywhere now.
They are. And engaging with them is the precise digital equivalent of buying the glass apartment in the Zinc Building.
Let's really think about the deal you are making. When you download one of these apps and sign up, you are actively seeking the view out. You want the connectivity.
You want the content.
You want the endless stream of entertaining content, the professional networking, the social utility of knowing what your friends are doing. You want to see the city skyline, so to speak.
Yes.
But to get that beautiful view out, you're willingly stepping into a structure built entirely of transparent code. You know, on some level, you're making yourself vulnerable. Hmm. You're allowing the parent company to look directly into your digital domestic life.
However, there is a severe asymmetry to this digital voyeurism that makes it significantly more insidious than the physical case study.
Awesome.
Think back to Tribeca. The inhabitants of the Zinc Building could, theoretically, look out their glass windows across the narrow street and see the brick building.
Right. They could literally see it.
They could see the specific dark window where a photographer might be standing with a telephoto lens.
Mm-hmm.
The threat is physical. It is locatable. You can point at it.
Oh, I see.
In the digital glass apartment, the watcher is entirely invisible. You know the platform is observing you, but the mechanisms of that observation are completely obfuscated.
Yeah, that's a huge difference. If I live in the Zinc Building and I catch a guy staring at me, I can go buy curtains. I can pull the blinds down.
Exactly.
But I can't buy curtains for Facebook. We know these platforms are looking in through the glass, but we do not know exactly how much they are looking.
We have no idea.
We don't know if they are just tracking what we click, or if they're tracking how many milliseconds our thumb hovers over a video of a luxury car before we keep scrolling.
And we do not know who specifically within that massive corporate structure is looking. We certainly do not know how all those disparate tiny data points of our behavior are being synthesized into incredibly complex predictive models.
And this brings us right to the nuance of data extraction and profit. Because just like Ani Svensson harvested the private sleepy moments of his neighbors to sell giant prints in a fancy gallery for a premium, these tech platforms harvest your behavioral data to generate massive corporate revenue.
That is the core transaction. They track what you look at, how long you linger on an image, what you might be hungry for based on the time of day.
Which they absolutely do.
They do. And even what emotional state you are currently experiencing based on your typing speed or the sentiment of your posts.
Wow.
That algorithmic exploitation for profit is the exact digital equivalent of hanging your sleeping form on a gallery wall and selling it to the highest bidder.
But, and this is where I think our source material really challenges the listener. We have to look at our own complicity in this exchange.
You do.
Are we really just innocent victims here? Users have a duty to understand the reality of the spaces they inhabit. You cannot sign up for a totally free platform that requires massive, energy-sucking server farms and thousands of highly paid engineers and pretend you don't understand that these companies must make money somehow.
It is the fundamental structure of reality for these applications. They have a vested existential interest in observing your behavior because, quite literally, your behavior is their product.
Right.
If you choose to reside in the algorithmic glass apartment, feigning ignorance of the invisible watcher is an abdication of your own intellectual responsibility.
That's a strong statement, but it tracks.
The monetization of your data is not a bug in the system. It is the load-bearing pillar of the entire architecture. Without the view in, the building collapses.
So let's synthesize these two realities. Remember the outrage we discussed at the very beginning with the Target pregnancy example?
Yes, the visceral reaction.
The intense, violating outrage you feel when a corporate algorithm knows your most intimate medical secrets before your own family does? At its core, that outrage is identical to the outrage of walking into a Tribeca art gallery and finding a giant photograph of yourself sleeping on your own sofa.
And both scenarios hinge entirely on the concept of user decision-making. In both realities, users made a conscious decision to enter a specific space, a transparent physical apartment, or a free digital social platform without fully calculating who might be looking in and why.
They just wanted to be in the space.
Yes. Even if the knowledge that observation was occurring lived somewhere on the very edge of their minds, they suppressed that knowledge. They traded it away in exchange for the utility of the space.
They wanted the view out so badly, they just ignored the implications of the view in.
This brings us to the core synthesis of our source material today. Privacy in the modern era, whether we are discussing the physical architecture of real estate or the algorithmic reality of the internet, is almost never lost by force. It is rarely taken from us in the dead of night by some malicious actor. It is usually traded away. We barter it.
We hand it over.
We trade our privacy for a spectacular view of the skyline, or for the friction-free convenience of predictive algorithms that know what we want to buy, or for the sheer unignorable necessity of social participation in a digitized world.
Yeah.
Whether you are signing a lease for a literal glass box in Tribeca, or hastily checking an I agree terms of service box on Instagram, you are actively participating in the commodification of your own visibility.
So as you, the listener, navigate your own digital architecture from this moment forward, you are forced to make a choice. And it's a choice between two entirely competing ethical goods. The logic of our source material presents a pretty brutal binary.
It does.
On one hand, you have absolute privacy. To achieve that, you must board up the glass windows. You must physically and digitally disconnect from the algorithms that govern modern connectivity, delete the apps, toss the smartphone, and accept a state of profound social isolation.
Alternatively, you have social utility. To maintain that connectivity, the convenience and the social presence required to function normally in the modern world, you must choose to live in the glass apartment.
You have to step inside.
You must accept, fully and without complaint, that your data, your behaviors, and your intimate preferences will be harvested, analyzed, and monetized by unseen observers.
There's no middle ground in a glass house. Which ethical good are you willing to sacrifice? And can human dignity survive the trade?